morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Norman Daniels, professor of philosophy at Tufts University, and our topic will be the role of government in providing universal health care. Norman, glad to have you on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
What if you could begin by giving the listener a sort of brief rationale for the idea that we should have universal health care?
Well, I think the idea is actually one that is many ways widely shared in our population. It's certainly a dominant idea in most developed countries, and we are about the only country in the world without universal health care coverage, the only developed country without universal health care coverage. My approach to the question asks, why should we think health care is so special? What's the moral importance that health care, or for that matter, health, adds to our lives? My answer is, put fairly simply, goes something like this. Disease and disability have a significant impact on the range of opportunities that are open to people. In a society that respects equality of opportunity, we ought to be paying careful attention to ways of protecting the range of opportunities of individuals. To the extent that health care promotes health, it thus plays a significant role in protecting that range of opportunities. Since protecting opportunity is seen as a societal obligation and not simply an individual one or an employer's obligation, I see the inference that one should draw as we have a societal obligation to promote opportunity through the provision of universal health care.
Okay, a couple of follow-up questions. I mean, what exactly are we meaning here by universal health care?
Well, we can mean many things, and many different countries have many different forms of organization of health care. The general claim I made doesn't help us decide among a lot of very specific differences. The main idea, though, goes something like this, that people should not be barred by inability to pay from getting access to an appropriate array of health care services that are aimed at protecting normal functioning in a society. Now, this can be organized through a national health system, which exists in some countries. In this country, we're probably most familiar with the British version of that, the British National Health Service. It can be organized through a universal health insurance scheme, and where there's a single financer of that. Revenues are collected by the government and pay for a universal insurance scheme, but the individuals working in that scheme are not necessarily salaried employees of a public institution such as the British National Health Service, but work on a fee-for-service basis, the way many of our old insurance schemes worked in this country. So the Canadian-style system is an example of that, where each province administers a separate version of the national health insurance scheme. Then there are some other European versions where there are several different levels of insurers, some public, some private, as in the Netherlands or Germany, but they are heavily regulated and required to provide a uniform benefit package for all citizens of those countries. And so you can see that universal health care can really take a lot of different organizational and financing forms.
You began by saying that the United States is alone in not having universal health care, at least alone among developed countries. Why is that? Is it that the United States has it right and everyone else has sort of gotten it wrong, or is there some reason why we are distrustful of the idea of universal health care, a fact which other countries see very plainly?
I think it's a long and complicated story, and there isn't one simple answer to the question why we don't have it, and most of the other countries that we have a lot of similarity to do. We have partial efforts at universal coverage. We do have Medicare, which is universally covers seniors in our society, and that is a public insurance scheme. We have Medicaid, which provides through state administration with federal requirements a level of insurance for the poorest segment of our population. But then we have about 45 million unemployed, uninsured people who are largely the working poor in our country, people who are not covered by employers for their insurance, often work in non-unionized contexts and for small employers who don't provide insurance. And many self-employed individuals cannot afford insurance of this sort. So we have as many people uninsured as a large country would have in Europe. And it's quite striking fact. But why are we in this situation? And I think the answer is quite complicated. Four or five times in this century, there have been very significant movements to introduce universal health care coverage in the United States. And historically, it's been opposed with vehemence by various interest groups. Often in the past, the American Medical Association opposed it. In the last effort at universal health care coverage, in the 1993 Clinton effort, the AMA didn't officially oppose it. It wasn't happy about aspects of the Clinton reform, but it wasn't an official opponent anymore. But in almost all previous efforts, the American Medical Association was a staunch opponent of universal health care coverage. Insurers in this country have been, private insurers, have been a significant opponent, especially in the last go-around under Clinton, when many of the smaller insurers united to fund public television ad campaign that cost $15 million. The famous Harry and Louise ads, which portrayed a middle-aged couple, middle-income couple, worried about their loss of choice under a Clinton-style program. The irony of that campaign is that many Americans feel they lost their health care choices without any of the possible benefits of universal coverage in the aftermath of the failure of the Clinton reform. So some people say maybe the reason we don't have universal coverage in this country is that Americans are too individualistic or too selfish, perhaps. We don't care about each other as much as people in other countries. And this is a very common explanation. In my view, it tends to overlook the enormous effort that's been made by specific, very powerful interest groups in opposing universal health care coverage. And in the last effort under Clinton, where a very complicated form of health insurance was being proposed, it was possible for interest groups to confuse the American public about what kind of insurance they might really get under that sort of system. So even in the exit polls following the 1994 congressional election, when Clinton's failure to get health care reform seemed to precipitate the loss of Congress by the Democrats, people still said they were in favor of universal health care coverage in this country, although obviously they had been somewhat confused by what happened. My sense is that we need to tell a very complicated story about the specific episodes in each case when it was opposed, to analyze what forces were at work to stop the movement for universal coverage, despite the fact that most Americans believe the principle that no one should be denied health care because they can't afford it.
You described earlier in talking about other countries that there are a variety of different ways in which this might be achieved. You could have a single-payer system run by the central government. You could have provinces or states running some kind of central plan. You could have some sort of mixture of governmental and private markets working together. What you've done so far is you've tried to explain the need for having universal health care. Now what I would like to ask you about, though, is what role specifically do you think government should or must play in providing universal health care? Maybe you can sort of give a general answer, and then we can talk about some of the details later on.
Well, let's suppose that any system that emerged in the United States might have to include a mix of public insurance and private insurance. Whereby private insurance, I mean, say, some mandated employer-based insurance, as would have been the case under the Clinton proposal in 93. The government role in that setting would have been to do the following crucial things. One is to require that everybody have insurance through some form of mandated coverage by employers, or a requirement that everybody who is self-employed buy into such a scheme of insurance. And the government would also have to publicly subsidize health care for those who couldn't buy in, or even where employers couldn't afford the full premium cost of an insurance plan. There would have to be a way of collecting revenues from across the whole population and subsidizing the care that's provided in that way. Crucial element of this is the public a guarantee of what a basic benefit package would be under that kind of insurance scheme. There are a number of different ways to try to define or specify such a package, and that would obviously determine the level of coverage for people who operated within that basic scheme. Then there are further questions about whether the government would tolerate supplementary insurance or insist that everyone have the same insurance. There are systems that work both ways in the world. The Norwegians and Canadians tend to discourage supplementary insurance. The British have allowed a tier of supplementary insurance. Any case, that the government would have to play the role of regulating the quality of insurance coverage, and indirectly then the quality of care that is provided people through that coverage. So the government cannot back away from the commitment to equity within the system. However much we have markets working within a mixed healthcare system, they require strong regulation, or there is a constant threat to equity within the system. European systems, which have experimented in various ways with economic measures attempting to emulate American market mechanisms in the hope that they could make their own systems more efficient, discovered throughout the earlier part of the 90s, when these experiments were going on, that without significant attention paid by the government to regulation of these measures, they risk transaction costs going up, equity being challenged within the system. So I think the fundamental task is to get the government to play the role of making sure that people across the whole population are treated equitably within whatever insurance scheme is provided.
Okay, so the principal role of the government, you mentioned there are really two things. The primary thing you mentioned was to ensure equity among all people who get care, and the second seemed to imply that the government involvement would actually help control costs. Could you say a little bit more about each of those points?
Yeah, in order to get universal coverage, you really do have to mandate that coverage be provided to everyone. Either that can be done through people getting, as citizens, a card that entitles them to services that are publicly funded, and as is the case, say, in Canada, or if you have a mixed system in which there's some private insurance and some public, you have to have a law that says everybody has to buy insurance. You can't leave it to volunteerism for people to get insurance, or people who think that they are at very low risk or think that they can, when all is said and done, fall back on public provision of services, even if they haven't paid for it or participated in schemes that collectively pay for it, then you will get people free riding on the system that everyone else is contributing to. So mandating coverage is a necessary condition to assure universality in a mixed system. The effect on cost. I actually didn't say anything about effects on cost. But if you look at most of the universal coverage systems we have in other countries, we find that they provide comparable or better health outcomes as measured by population measures of mortality and morbidity in those countries. For example, life expectancy. Measures, infant mortality measures, incidence of various disease conditions, and so on. In those countries that have universal coverage, the systems tend to spend between 40 and 60% per capita what we spend on health care and get better or comparable outcomes to what we get. Now, the fact that they get comparable better outcomes is itself not necessarily all due to the universal provision of health care. And this is an extremely important point to understand. Americans have generally been led to believe that, like people in many other countries, that it is medical care that is responsible for our high levels of population health. After all, in the past century, people have lived longer, healthier lives than any time in human history. And most people attribute that success to medical care, magic bullets that medicine has provided to fight disease. But that's really not a correct analysis of why population health is so much better in the past century than it was throughout human history before that. Many people have studied this phenomenon. And there's a broad understanding in the social science and epidemiological literature that the real reasons for vast improvements in life expectancy and population health actually come from phenomena outside the health sector altogether. Better nutrition, better housing, better water supplies, plus various public health measures that were taken in the late 19th and early 20th century. Very late in the whole story has been the emergence of some effective medical treatments, including antibiotics, in the middle of the century. But very little of the improved population health that we see around the world is directly the result of improved medical, personal medical services. Much more of it is the result of social and public health measures. I mention this as an important background condition because the literature on social determinants of health also shows that inequalities in the distribution of important goods, income, education, quality of housing, has a significant impact on population health and the incidence and distribution of disease conditions within that population. so that when we look at another system, which may be overall more equitable than the American system in its distribution of income or housing, or may lack some of the history, say, of racism that we have in this country, what we will find is better levels of population health. Now, when we look at those other countries and look at the fact that they have universal health care systems, the natural inference might be to attribute the much better health outcomes in those countries to the existence of a universal coverage health system. But it may in fact be the case that those countries have distributed other social goods in ways that help assure those good health outcomes, whether or not they had a universal health care system. It just happens to coincide with the fact that countries that are more concerned about the equitable distribution of those other goods are also more concerned to provide universal coverage to health care. So the things work together.
You know, you indicate that in most of the developed world, the government plays a really pivotal role in providing universal health care. Americans tend to assume that government involvement in anything is going to be inefficient, ineffective, or downright wasteful. And that would explain at least in part why most people or many people in this country are leery of the government playing such an important role. What would you say to someone who says, look, the government just is not the sort of organization that's capable of delivering these goods? We can see that from the history. We can see that governments are ineffective. We can see that governments are inefficient. We can see that governments are wasteful. If we try to do this, we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Well, I already gave, in a certain way, a partial answer to that question. If we look at other countries where governments do deliver universal health coverage, and again, they may not be actually delivering the services, as in Britain, but simply insurance for the services, as say in Canada. What one finds is systems that are, on the whole, more efficient than our American system. So the supposition that the government financing or government provision is bound to be inefficient is simply a misconception the public has. Now, we could ask the question, why does it have that misconception? And I think it's partly it's a result of what people are taught about the government. In our country, we have relatively few models of the government delivering services to people or insuring people for certain services. And in other countries, there is a broader spectrum of lessons that can be learned from the fact that services are being delivered on a broader scale through publicly funded and publicly responsible mechanisms. So part of the reason we may be more suspicious is that we, in a sense, have fewer examples in our midst. What we do have is Medicare. And it's quite striking. People are very reluctant to privatize Medicare. People are very reluctant to privatize Social Security. So it's not true that the American public is automatically skeptical of government programs. Those are two programs that are have taught the American public a lesson about the appropriateness of government or government role in the delivery of certain kinds of security to people. I would hope that lesson could be generalized and we could find out other ways to build on those lessons so that people are less skeptical of the role of government.
Okay, it's a bit shocking here. We've only got about 3 minutes left. I know that you've done some work where you and some of the colleagues identify what you call some benchmarks for evaluating reform of health care. I wonder just in that 2.5 minutes if you might give a snapshot about how that might work in evaluating proposals for changing and providing universal health care.
I worked with a sociologist named Don Light and an economist named Ron Kaplan to develop a matrix for evaluating comprehensive health insurance reform proposals in the United States. In this what was then a 10-dimensional matrix for measuring healthcare reform, on the different aspects of fairness, we included concerns about equity of access, barriers to care, for example, financial and non-financial. We were concerned about levels of coverage. What exactly did you have access to, and how unequal was that in a system? We had a couple of benchmarks that focused on the fairness of financing and the principles underlying that concerned the fact that it's important for people who can afford to pay for care to cross-subsidize those who cannot. So ability to pay should not be your basis for getting care, but your basis for contributing to health care costs. And we shouldn't load the burden of those costs on people who are sickest or at highest risk. Also, concerns about efficiency play a role in fairness, because if a system has limited resources and it's very inefficient, then we meet people's needs less, and that's unfair to them. Also, a system has to have accountable processes through which it makes decisions about how to limit care and provide it fairly to all under resource constraints. Similarly, there are concerns about other issues like the choices that are available to people about treatment and providers. On all these different dimensions of fairness, it's possible to set up more specific criteria and evaluate healthcare reform. A project I've been involved with internationally has been adapting these benchmarks, American benchmarks, for use in developing countries. And that adaptation has gone through a first phase in which collaborating teams in Pakistan, Thailand, Mexico, and Colombia have produced adaptations that were acceptable in those very different systems with very different cultures. So what this said to me was that it was possible to get some international consensus on what constituted a fair delivery system for healthcare.
Okay, well, that's certainly very intriguing. Perhaps I'll even have you in the show next year to talk about that, but for the moment we've run out of time.
Well, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed talking to you today. I've been talking to Norman Daniels, professor of philosophy at Tufts University, and our topic has been the role of government in providing universal health care. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.